production.
Here we go again. We are taking it down a podcast where we affably unpack TV and film for progressive, busy Alabama people. This podcast is produced by the site thealabamatech.com, where you can find plenty of writings and plenty of podcasts. I'm one of the hosts of Taking It Down. My name is Blaine Duncan. Here's why it's me. This show exists because not only did I find myself missing the Vulture TV podcast, but I often find myself sharing why I like what I like and why I dislike what I dislike. I have an English teacher's mind, so why not use it to contemplate film, TV, and music? I was once a classic kid who grew up in front of a TV set and was thrilled to visit a movie theater. My ideas aren't the only set of viewpoints here, so you're in luck. With me every week, Adam Morrow, an erudite musician with a penchant for fine literature, Donovan Runwald, a media specialist with encyclopedic knowledge on film and more, as well as Natalie Morrow, the first person to ask about fantasy, sci-fi, comics, trashy reality TV, and Beyonce. From us, you'll get the obscure and the obvious from TV and film for your analysis. For this week's Taking It Down, we're finally watching the much-ballyhooed Marilyn Monroe film titled Blonde. It was released this past week on Netflix. We'll briefly talk about another Netflix phenomenon, which is Dahmer. Seems like everyone's watching it. We will then discuss a bit of Andor and maybe clear the way for our sister podcast, We Are a Star War, to say a lot more about that. Finally, we'll have some thoughts on the sixth episode of House of the Dragon, because we are a week behind everyone's watching schedule, assuming you get to watch it live on Sunday. Autumn is here. Gather around the leaf pile, set that sumbitch on fire, and give us a listen. Here are the hosts. Actually, no Natalie this week. I always include our hosts just so you know them, you understand their ethos. No Natalie this week, but let me introduce everyone else. First up is a guy who gets really pissed off with Lee Bain's chords. It's Mr. Adam Morrow.
Just pissed, angry, spitting mad. Good to be back. I missed you guys last week.
Welcome back. Who else we got from there? We got this poor guy actually works when he goes to work. Mr. Donovan Reinwald.
Thanks for having me, Blaine.
Oh, not with us is Natalie Morrow, but she would usually chime in. She's out testing Dilly Bar flavors.
She is on the road, but I'm not sure that's what's going on.
The Dilly Bar Rhymes Again, I believe, is the title of this week's adventure.
Where do we start? Do we want to just dive in?
It's an interesting sports weekend we just had.
Oh, God.
Do you want to talk about it, Donovan?
I went to church where I was praying to the Lord.
I also went to the Church of Holland.
I went to look down at a text from Adam asking me if I'm enjoying the Derby, which I assume means that I am not enjoying it. Then I looked it up.
I told you it was a work of art. Two hat tricks in one game. That was a good, it was soothing to watch after a weird Alabama football game Saturday that kind of made me not enjoy Auburn losing quite as much later.
So I had to leave that game at halftime because I went to a fundraiser for my school. So I had just the score pinned on my phone, and I was checking in with it. And I got real nervous at some points. When it was like 23-29. I think it was 23-29. It looks like they squeaked out with a pretty comfortable margin of victory. But
it got out of hand very quickly from a tight situation.
Yeah.
Kind of went the way I expected. Alabama still covered. I kind of thought it would do exactly what it did, except with Alabama scoring maybe a touchdown less.
I could have seen it being, obviously the injury is why, but more of a game of attrition early on, you know, kind of a low scoring thing. That's why I thought they wouldn't cover. But for them to run it up so much and then the injury slowed things down, the narrative of the game was not what I was expecting.
Anybody want to take a second to shit on Auburn?
Turnovers are fun, especially when they're happening to Tigers.
Could
I'm kind of
shitting
on LSU too,
please?
Yeah. A little bit here. Watching them duel, so I got back in time to watch them duel turnovers at the end of the game there. That was a lot of fun. Somebody tweeted, which I thought this was pretty good. Somebody tweeted something like, this Auburn game is nothing but them cutting to Brian Harsin on the sidelines. Not a good sign.
Not great.
And it's true. They kept showing his face.
Everyone's picking up on the fact that that guy does not want to be in Lee County, Alabama.
Who does?
You don't think he upgraded from wherever Boise, Idaho is to Lee County, Alabama?
I think he was happier in Boise.
Once Adam called, can't even remember who they were playing, but Auburn won a game and Adam called him winning the Lee County Classic. And now that's just how I think of that's just how I think of Auburn games.
That was pretty good.
Interesting sartorial choice from Brian Kelly to wear the polo with buttoned all the way up.
You got to wonder about people who do that. I know that's a stylistic choice for some, but daggum.
He was going to the Lee County Classic. Yeah. You want to look your best. There were some truly great crowd reaction shots, too, last night. Every time Auburn fumbled or got through a pick or whatever they did. It must be the easiest job in the world to be a camera operator with an Auburn crowd. Because they'd zoom in on the crowd and there's some girl, like, chewing on her pom-pom or something like that. Like, just absolutely losing, like a beaver.
Conversely, going to the LSU fans who appear to be having a blast at all times. Like, even sarcastically at their own ill fortune or bad playing, like, they're still, like, they flashed over when they were down and had, like, done something marginally good, and they're all just, like, losing their minds dancing in the stands.
It's not a bad gig being an LSU fan on the road. Well, anyway, we'll sweep the mess up here and make some room for TD and Greg, who cover this with much more nuance and accuracy than us. Listen to Taking On Sports every Monday from our network of podcasts. Our wheelhouse is more like what we're about to get into. I don't recall as much talk about a movie as I have with Blonde, with the exception of Don't Worry, Darling, which is basically very similar release schedule. They both released in the past couple of weeks. Blonde getting a lot of coverage, though, but pre-release and post-release. Totally different set of reasons for each one. We're focusing on Blonde, though. It's a film by Andrew Dominik about the turbulent, maybe even unknown parts of Marilyn Monroe's life, but it's based on the writing of Joyce Carol Oates. So, fair warning, if you think this is factual, it's not. It's complete fiction. The only other Dominik movies I've seen are The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. I've seen that one. And I've seen Killing Them Softly. Now, I loved Killing Them Softly.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, I saw it in a theater, and it was just propulsive and entertaining, and I really enjoyed it. The Assassination of Jesse James is a tough hang.
That one's a lot longer.
Because it is so damn long. But I did find it striking. Visually and the key moments that probably could have been edited down to those key moments, I think they were good, and it's a pretty good movie. Anyway, we're going to talk about Blonde. This is one of those movies that wants you to understand it is art with a capital A.
Yeah, you're dead on.
It tries a lot of film tricks to different degrees of effect. I mean, you name a film trick and it's in this movie. You got extreme close-ups, swirling LSD haze during sex, the score being louder than the dialogue, cutting from black and white to color. Name one. Name another one. It's in here. It's expressionistic to the point of boring.
That was the one thing that I was coming ready to praise was maybe not how often it's used, and maybe it's because I'm trying to find something nice to say, specifically when they were doing moments that are fairly iconic, or at least are in places that are fairly iconic, the way that they kind of blended what we remember and are kind of burned into our cultural subconscious of still images, they did an interesting job creating moving pictures of. You talked about going from black and white to color and the aspect ratio changing and all these things. Very early on, I'm like, did we just completely abandon telling a semi-linear story in a normal way? You know, like Marilyn Monroe's life should have been interesting enough to do a fairly clean biopic about. I mean, I don't want to fault anybody for trying hard and digging deep in the creative well, but I mean, it was just like they tried everything.
Yeah, he did. There's been a couple of movies that approach Monroe's life as, you know, a more linear. I called it boring, and it is, but I do think it's good.
You thought it was good?
I think it can be boring and good. Yeah, I did.
I thought it was really kind of good.
I thought it was good. I thought it was sad. What it was trying to do, it did. And seemed relatively worth the attempt. But it was still too long and too boring. But let me phrase it like this, and I think it'll clean up some of my thoughts. It's a movie that has way more interesting things written about it than it actually is watching it. Mm. I was really happy it was released on Netflix because I would read things as I was watching the movie. And I can't imagine watching this movie in a theater. I think I would have walked out. But then again, maybe not. Maybe I would have been more compelled to sit with it.
It would have looked good on a big screen.
Man, it really would have. It did look good. Looked good. You know, I mentioned the score earlier. Any surprise that Nick Cave did it?
No, especially because he did Coward Robert Ford, right?
Andrew Dominik, the director, and Nick Cave are supposedly on speed dial with one of their friends. There's a chunk of this movie that's one of those movies from Hollywood about Hollywood, and those can feel so disconnected from anything I understand or live. Well, I look to movies to show me something universal and speak to that, and the great ones do that. They offer up something universal, speak to it in a different way or different thought. This one lost a little of its universal path. It could be cleaned up to be a much more engaging movie, I think. Engaging in the way that it would hit more people's lives and what we go through. But like I said, my opening assertion there was it's at times a Hollywood movie about Hollywood. And those to me are sometimes the worst.
I thought about that a lot because I also read a bit during the movie. And, you know, reading that it got...
Okay, good.
A 14-minute...
Phone in front of you?
Yeah. So it just completely failed the did I look at my phone test, my old standby, which I want to circle back to.
Yeah.
But reading that it got a 14-minute standing ovation at whatever festival it debuted at, you know, everybody in the room is in that world. And so maybe it speaks to them in that direct personal way that you're talking about. Somebody dealing with this slimy system and getting taken advantage of and blah, blah, blah. But there were flashes of interesting ideas. You know, like she says, this is somebody going through, like, at a time when mental health is more openly talked about now than maybe at any other point that a movie about her has been made. And of course, it's incredibly dangerous to diagnose people who were been dead for 50 years or 60 years. But early on, she says, what happens when dreams and reality blur? They kind of do a good job of showing, not telling that as it goes along. But everything that had like these hints of being interesting and like you could do something really nuanced with that, like here's an interesting story to tell or perspective, they kind of just blew right past. Like I found myself, not only am I like, did I look at my phone? It kind of elevated to, would I tell somebody to sit through this? Because it's like 3 hours long, right? We've already said it's a tome of a movie. So you got to really be in. I started thinking, no, even though there's movies that I didn't particularly have fun watching, but I'm glad that I watched. Like the experience, I'm like, oh, I appreciate art in a deeper way because of this film. It just got me thinking, should this movie have been made? Should this movie exist? And after watching it and thinking about it and reading about it, I kind of think no, which is maybe the most severe position I've ever taken on a movie. You know, because most of the time it's just like, it's not hurting anyone by existing, generally. And this one was so destructive to her and almost everybody who was on screen and the way that it portrayed her struggles and like took a pretty strong, I thought, anti-abortion stance, which we don't have to discuss the politics of that, but it was just like it was just a lot going on that I wasn't here for it.
I do believe it hews real closely to Joyce Carol Oates's writing.
Well, then I don't want to read that book.
Yeah, exactly.
There are some authors that write too much, and I think Joyce Carol Oates is one of them. Take that for whatever it's worth.
As I fired up this one, opening Netflix, using the remote, picking it, pressing the button, it really hit me in that moment. I really don't know shit about Marilyn Monroe other than the basics.
Mm-hmm.
I really only know her as an image, as an icon. And I feel like this is a very similar relationship to young people this day and time have with, say, Elvis. That was the immediate example I could think of. Just as a picture, as an icon, maybe a song. Blonde definitely plays with that idea that we don't know. I think there are a lot of thematic ideas in this movie, and one of them is that we don't know those people we see a lot. Or more accurately, we don't know the people we idolize, for good or bad. It really wants to hammer some of those things home. Like, you don't know the trouble people are going through, especially years removed, and when you put them in a godlike position.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the way that she constantly differentiates between herself and Marilyn. You know, that she never fully embraces the stage name as an identity. And I thought those were clever touches for a 3-hour, much promoted, much in the discourse kind of film. Like, if that's one of the better things that I can say about it, that's not exactly the most original thing. It's an interesting idea, but that's not really like an earth-shattering thing to like explore fame and the double-sidedness of it.
One of the other major thematic points it wants to make in really ham-fisted way is her search for love because she didn't have it from her parent. I still found that deeply saddening. And that was one of its universal points. It almost stuck. I mean, that was pretty harrowing sadness. Yeah. It worked throughout the whole thing, I think. Ana de Armas, that's probably not a correct pronunciation of the actress's name. She was fantastic, though. She paired the look of the film with great acting. It's a tough movie. It's a super tough movie, I think, purposefully, in the ways that I suppose movies can be tough, in two or three different ways that they can be. I didn't like it that much as far as watching it. People who really dig movie making might dig it. People who want others to know that they dig movie making will act like it's great.
It's being pretty universally panned right now, right? I mean, there's like been some scathing reviews.
The biggest issues that critics are having with it is that Dominic is simply using Marilyn Monroe for some of these ideas. That's the case with Joyce Carol Oates' work as well. And from what I gather, it's a faithful adaptation, but he's just using her as a symbol rather than telling her actual story, which is also what happens to her in the movie. I don't know. It's like she's a thing, of course. That's one of the big ideas happening.
No, I was going to say, I have a question for y'all, which is concerning the rating. I'm curious, because, you know, this is obviously part of the buzz, is it's Netflix's first NC-17 film. Was it worth it?
No. I think it was done almost entirely so that we would be talking about it right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I didn't really
Especially her JFK scene.
Yeah, yeah.
The movie got really close to being effective was this tragic, very sad abortion scene, which was forced on her by the Secret Service, and they had broken in, and she was almost in a paranormal activity filmed sort of way. If the rest of the movie had been kind of like that, if he'd went in that direction with the surreal, it might have worked. It was scary, even. He was able to achieve a certain tone. Then suddenly the score goes really heavy on Twin Peaks, to the point where I was like, how are they getting away with this with copyright? This is Twin Peaks' theme. And as it turns out, I think David Lynch had a bit of Marilyn Monroe in mind for Laura Palmer at times.
Possibly not a coincidence that I rewatched my favorite clip on the internet, which is Angelo Badalamenti writing the Twin Peaks theme. Have you guys ever watched that? He's telling the story of David sitting... David Lynch, he calls him David. So David Lynch sitting at his Rhodes piano beside Angelo Badalamenti and describing, and he even like kind of does a Lynch voice, which is very funny. There's a girl walking out of the woods, and it's so sad and scary, and now, but is she so beautiful? And that's like when it da, 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 does all that kind of, it's great. Donovan, stop what you're doing after we finish taping. Watch it. Listener, pause us. Go and watch it. Come back.
It's worth it. The way that this movie, I think, could have been excellent, of course, trim the time. I'm big on keeping a story under a certain amount of time. But I think if the central figure had been completely fictional.
But does it lose some of the gravity that she provides? Even though I disagree with... Not disagree, I just don't think it's a great tool that they used her to make these points, because she is someone that's pretty beloved and people are still sensitive about, like, everybody knows that she was taken advantage of and was unwell, this list of things, and kind of had this tragic life. It seems like that's a big point that a lot of the critics have had, is do we really need to pile on more on this woman who, you know, if you look at what the front page was on the day that she died, it's people just immediately are just shitting all over her. Crazy woman kill self in bed, naked, holding phone. Mm-hmm. Like, just her whole life down to its end was, you know, the original, not the original, but the biggest 20th century example of the gossip column becoming front page news.
Yeah, I think if you did it fictionally, you'd have to establish that central character as a idol very quick.
Was interesting in this because they didn't really build her. She was unknown, and then she became, through that brutal scene of meeting with that studio exec, all of a sudden she's kind of a big deal, you know, and becomes a bigger deal. And they didn't really do anything with her. Not that I wanted them to spend time on the ladder climbing of Marilyn Monroe, but she just kind of was, you know, they skimmed a lot of years there. But then they kind of drove the point home in, a show don't tell kind of way with the subway grate scene. When they zoomed out and you discover that there's an entire crowd of, and there's a great shot where you know that it couldn't actually look like this. It's a surrealist shot because they actually did shoot that scene originally in New York and had to redo it later. I looked it up. They shot it at, they started shooting at 1 a.m. in New York, and she still attracted hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. But when they zoom out and they show just how many folks were there, and like you can't even see the end of the crowd, like clearly that's like more than could be fit on a city street and sidewalk. You know, to do that and then have DiMaggio just standing there kind of seething, that was good. Mm-hmm. More of that.
Yeah, go more surrealist. Same example I was using with the Secret Service sort of forcing her, taking her to get an abortion. I'll end with something I began with, wrap it up. Blonde is 100% one of those examples of cinema that has more fascinating writings about it, but sadly for most of those essays to hit, you would have had to sit through the movie. So, but let's stick with some Netflix stuff. It's another phenomenon. It's another true story being presented. I told Donovan last week that Dahmer from Ryan Murphy and Evan Peters is the star. He's the titular monster. It had been popping up a lot in my timeline, a lot of social media feeds I kept seeing talked about, but also in a lot of real life conversations. You know, I'm creepily overheard a bunch of conversations because I'm not invited to many. I'm not a Ryan Murphy fan by any stretch. That's a conversation we've had on here a couple times. I tend to avoid his work, but I have enjoyed docudrama productions in the past. Like his American Crime Story series with O.J. Simpson was really good. And I've really grown to like Evan Peters' work lately, so this was meeting me halfway. And I've watched 3 episodes. It's actually, the look of it is really good. It's really dropping you into a time and place perfectly. And it's, at times, even Murphy will use that late 80s, early 90s to open your eyes on how dangerous stereotypes can be and how those were the reasons he got away with some of what he did. The stereotypes of gay men, the stereotypes of black people, which he used as his prey, gay black men, usually, in many cases, or brown men, honestly. It was, there's an example, I think, of a South American guy. It's, the reviews on this one is basically saying, they're not using the word glamorize, but they're saying that we should focus more on the victims rather than the perpetrator. That's very true, and there are deep, incredible stories with them. But this is one of the most watched Netflix show since Stranger Things, I think, and maybe one of the more most watched Netflix show in a while. People are watching it. I see why. I'm watching it, and I'm going to finish it because it's well done. Do I feel icky? Sometimes. Though sometimes I don't. Sometimes I just want to know what happened because I didn't do a deep dive after he was arrested or when this was national news.
The show itself, does it mostly, is Dahmer mostly our viewpoint character?
Through 3 episodes, yes. 100%. Okay. Yes. I think it veers into other character stories, other characters, hell, victims story.
Yeah.
I think it's supposed to. But it hasn't through 3.
So that's where maybe the charge of not valorizing, glamorizing Dahmer.
Yeah, and I used the wrong word. I don't think anyone would make that claim that it's glamorizing it at all. But they're using Dahmer's story to churn out some television.
Yeah.
To me, it's a lot like after the tornado came through Tuscaloosa in 2011, I kept watching videos of different angles of that same tornado, just trying to think, what can I do next time? What do I need to look for? Some of that's going on here for me. I'm just thinking, what causes this? Where did it come from? What are signs people could look for?
People have such an endless, I'm kind of wondering when the podcast craze around killing stories or Netflix kind of being maybe the most, they've embraced that more than the other streaming networks, and it almost feels like lowest common denominator. You know, like it's a clickbait essentially thing for streaming, but it's also like deeply in human nature to want to know these stories, and like I don't think I think there are people who make it out to be a, and obviously I would, whatever a victim's family feels, I will defer to that on how they feel about this show, you know, but I know that it can't be an entirely unhealthy impulse to look at another human's behavior and like kind of want it, like you're saying, like how does that happen? I don't think it's necessarily just like car crash staring. You know what I mean? I think there's something else to it.
It's good in this way. The show is good in this way. Episode 2 had a statement it wanted to make, and it made it. Not as even-handedly as it could, but it did. Episode 3 had a statement it wanted to make, and it did it. It's episodic in that way, and it's as television, it's working a little bit like that. Is it gross and icky? Sometimes, for sure.
You might really be interested in, I mentioned it before the show, but the graphic novel My Friend Dahmer.
I very much am.
It's by the graphic novelist who goes by Durf Backdurf. I can't remember what his legal, I don't remember what his government name is. he's written a couple interesting, he's wrote one about his time, a slightly fictionalized account of his time working as a trash man, which is pretty interesting and goes into some of America's waste problems and stuff. So he can kind of take a big screen view of things. Part of it, he actually grew up with Jeffrey Dahmer, like knew him in high school. Mm-hmm. And part of his story is how did this happen? Where were the adults? Where were the people in his life?
Right.
And it does a really good job of kind of digging into that. So if you're enjoying Dahmer, I can definitely recommend My Friend Dahmer. By Durf Backdurf.
Good one, and I do want to read that. I'll add that to my Goodreads list. Just to clear up any moments of being vague earlier, episode 2 of Dahmer, central idea was about how horrible, degrading stereotypes can perpetuate even worse things. And the episode 3 was about what you're talking about, Donovan. It was an examination of how could this happen. So, yeah, okay. Let's take a break. On the other side, we'll talk Andor and 6th episode of House of the Dragon in that order. A quick programming note for all who listen on a weekly basis, we'll have no episode of Taking It Down next Tuesday. This podcast is produced by The Alabama Take, where you can find a lot of essays on pop culture and a lot of podcasts. Mondays, you can listen to Take It On Sports. Tuesdays, it's us. Wednesdays, the first Wednesday of every month, you can check out Check Your Shelf, which will be out tomorrow if you listen to us on Tuesday. Thursdays, in late fall, coming soon, This Song Sucks. On Fridays, Alabama Slam. Sporadically, you can also hear We Are a Star War, which they're going to be covering Andor very soon. If that's too much to remember, just follow The Alabama Take on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok for announcements of when and where. If you'd like to help the site in any way, one of the best ways to do is go to our site, click on shop, go into our Tee Public store, and find yourself something. You can also donate to help the site continue. Let's get back into Taking It Down. Andor, 4th episode.
Andor.
Andor. Or as we would say in Sulligit, Ander.
Ander.
You're Cassian Ander. Yeah, Cassian Ander.
What's his nom de plume in this episode? Is it Clem?
Clem, which is his father's name.
Oh, is that?
I don't know how we're supposed to know that, but I uncovered that information for us.
I just thought, I was just like, Clem, what a great, you know, it's kind of like, what's your name? Jason.
If you want more unpacking of Star Wars stuff, I recommend We Are a Star War from our podcast network. We will cover it less granularly, I suppose, or we will cover it less in depth.
I think they're going to catch things that I, as more of a casual fan, would miss too.
Yeah, for sure. So I watched this one with captions, and I don't know how anyone could watch it any other way.
I watched it with captions too.
This 4th episode dropped a lot of names, dropped a lot of places, dropped a lot of information. A
lot of new characters.
Yeah, it was going at, if you'll forgive me, it was going at light speed on its information.
At the same time, I think I might be part of the problem. I found myself a little bored by this episode.
You did?
just because it was very much a table setting episode. We're getting to reference The Simpsons. We're going to the fireworks factory. Let's see if we get there. There was a lot of place setting, a lot of new, like you said, new characters, new names, new locations. We got the whole heist plan described to us, and we got Ma and Mothma thrown into the mix, and all in the same episode.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an ambitious Imperial Security Bureau officer who seems like she's being set up to be one of the antagonists.
Yeah, right. And then we get the even lower level guy who got sent home to Mama.
Yeah. And we have, they're sticking with the story of the corporate security guy whose name I can't remember right now. I did enjoy the dressing down scene, just because he's in his perfectly tailored suit, perfectly stiff. That guy's doing a good job as playing this guy as someone who's totally in over his head.
Yeah, I dug it, man. I'm really digging. This is where I was hoping the show would go, and it's in these granular aspects of the rebellion. You know, Mon Mothma's, she's in the Senate. How does she get information out? Look how hard it is for her to get any information without getting exposed or killed. And, you know, her husband's a real douche.
Yeah, no kidding.
He's inviting Alex Jones and Newt Gingrich to dinner while she's trying to plan for abortion rights, you know, so to speak.
No, I do kind of agree with you in that I hope they keep going into the nitty gritty of like, what's Mon Mothma doing in the Senate?
Yeah. You know? Yes. No one.
What's going on?
It's a lot of distrust too, and yeah. I find that interesting. Not as action packed in the foreground, so to speak, but it's intellectually engaged, action packed.
That's why I said I think I'm part of the problem. Because I found it a little slow and a little boring, because I think it's making the right moves.
Yeah,
and I think it's actually, I think if it was just giving me that sugar high, that Star Wars sugar high, we would have something much more like The Mandalorian or, God forbid, The Book of Boba Fett. And it clearly does not want to be that. It's clearly more interested in taking its time, kind of letting the characters breathe a little bit, letting you get to know the characters.
Uh-huh.
This is a case where it's like, what I'm asking for and what I think is good for me are two different things.
Yeah.
Like, I want my sugar and I want my cavities, but I think I think the vegetables that I'm being fed are more nutritious in the long run.
I felt like this episode really displayed that this show wants to be Game of Thrones sans tits.
Just with
the intrigue.
The intrigue. That's the only word that came into my head. Two, so far, have you noticed that this is something that stuck out to me, just because often in the Star Wars universe, guns don't really look like guns. They kind of look like, but the rebels, guns that the rebels were, or the thieves, the guys that are going to steal the payroll, were using, mm-hmm. looked a lot more like AK-47s.
Yeah, they did.
And I think it's trying to go with that kind of same thing that Game of Thrones did. That's a good analogy, where it's like, we're the grittier, more realistic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's more realism here, there's more. And I think that's just one example of a small design choice that they made that kind of nudging you in that direction.
Other than mapping out all its references, which is, I'm not your guy, we are Star Wars podcast. There's not a lot to unpack in this episode. I'm going to make this opinion.
Okay.
One of the most important things a show like Andor could do, and it might be doing as it's going, is to show that Vader's quest about Luke Skywalker and Luke Skywalker's quest about Darth Vader was unimportant and totally familial and maybe even juvenile in the grand scheme of the Empire staying together and maintaining order, or breaking apart the Empire and keeping it from maintaining order.
You know, I would love to get some of that. And I think that,
you know, even a comment like, you hear about this Vader guy? Fuck yeah, man, we're trying to keep government together. Or the Rebellion guys would be the complete opposite conversation.
I'm wondering if they can do something that I think Rogue One did really well, which is make it feel big, make the scale of what you're working with, make it feel real. Like, I mean, it's Star Wars, right? So there's going to be a little bit of, it is a fantasy. Already we've seen more of this as like that kind of bigness of like the Imperial bureaucracy and government, and the bigness of like the different rebel groups that are starting to coalesce.
Yeah, I think it's kind of touching to see that the Rebellion didn't jumpstart because it had a Jedi.
Yeah. No, Luke just happened to, at least the, if we can...
They kind of just got lucky.
He stumbled into it, yeah. It's interesting that you say that, because I think that this was some of those same things that the somewhat controversial, depending on where you stand, movie. Some people did not like this movie because of it decentering Luke and Luke's importance. But I think that that movie, which is my favorite of the new Star Wars movies, besides mm-hmm. Rogue One is my favorite one. Mm-hmm. But of the new Star Wars trilogy, that one's my favorite one. I think it's doing kind of what you alluded to, which is like this decentering of, like, you know, Luke and Vader as the center of everything. Even the Jedi as the center of everything, you know, mm-hmm. like with Rey's parents, at least in that one, they were just nobodies. She's got to learn the Jedi traditions are kind of pushed to the side. Luke is a grumpy old man on a, you know, bitter old man who hasn't done anything. And that really stuck in the craw of some people. So I'm wondering if this is going to stick in the craw, or if they're going to have to try and tie in the Skywalker saga in some other way to this one.
No, that's not the plan. They're doing two seasons. The first season covers a year of the Rebellion. The second season covers the next four or five.
Yes.
As it's moving forward, gaining momentum. I think people will be okay with Andor doing those kinds of things, doing this low-level grassroots kind of thing, because that's expected. I don't think no one's coming into this thinking that they're going to see Luke or Leia again.
That makes sense. We're not talking to Obi-Wan here.
Right, exactly. That's it. Okay, we'll shift gears a little bit. Still very much palace intrigue.
Very much.
Our listeners know each week we're a week behind simply because of our recording schedule, but it's just so much fun to talk about House of the Dragon. This episode's going to be the sixth one. It was the one that was titled The Princess and the Queen. This is the one where our younger actors got aged out, and we're 10 years in the future. 10 years beyond the wedding ceremonies, which ended with a little bit of punching.
Yeah, a little bit. A tad. Yeah. This was the first one where I think the time jump disoriented me a little bit, just because we had new characters to catch up with.
Mm-hmm.
Or especially... Oh, now I'm blanking on his name. Is it Herwin Strong? The master of the
Harwin?
City Watch? Harwin.
Yeah, but they were all playing very familiar roles. I don't blame you for being disoriented, but it's, you know, he's just picking up the role of Sir Criston.
That's true.
You know, it's like, oh, she still does this thing. She still needs a man, and she prefers, obviously, the knights, one of the knights, so that's what's happening. He just, don't know how it came to be, but... Same role.
But it's still, I guess that's a good point. It's just the episode kind of asked me to, felt like, at least for him, especially with his, spoiler alert, untimely demise at the end there, like they wanted him to, me to have a little bit more familiarity with him than I felt like I had.
This is
true. We've seen much more of his brother than we have of him. I think he was in the background of some scenes.
I think so. Yeah, you're right. No, it's wanting you to put a lot of emotional investment in a guy you just met. I read some critics that had a little bit of a gripe, like this was the time jump that should have been. This is the one that should have had some brakes pumped a little. I get it. The other biggest gripe from critics was, why do the birth scenes always have to be painful in this series?
your initial thesis, Blaine, which was, you know, this is the women's battlefield.
Yeah, well, they even say that in episode one.
Yeah, and you kind of pourted out how they were doing the tourney at the same time that they're doing the birthing scene. So you get the men,
mm-hmm.
you know, doing their thing, and then the women doing their battle, too.
Mm-hmm. I don't have a gripe about those birth scenes, because they're using them to make a point. Damon's wife, at the end, having a hard time with birthing. We're all over the place. Let's focus with King's Landing just for a second.
Yeah, because it starts with Rhaenyra,
yes,
giving birth to.
That's true, and it ends with Mr.
Joffrey,
who gets named instantly without any conversation.
Yeah,
Aegon, who's the Viserys' oldest son, and they've had more since in the 10 years. Aegon is a teenage asshole. Does like some.
He
likes public wanking.
He's a teenage dirtbag.
Yeah, for sure. He is a dirtbag.
He likes wanking, and he likes to bully his younger brother and his cousins, who he's bigger and stronger than.
Rhaenyra is still enjoying, you know, her time with a knight, Harwin. I thought this was really complex and makes viewers, me, I'll speak for myself, it made me want to see how any of that could be resolved. I think the conflict here is so well done and multiplied and, like I said, complex that I'm just interested in keeping up with it. And also it's like, okay, how will that play out? Well, if this is fixed in this way, won't it have reverberations on these other things?
Sure. Whenever, every week when I Google Game of Thrones, my little Google thing says, oh, it's about the Targaryen Civil War. And with the way things were at the end of this episode, no wonder there's going to be a Targaryen Civil War. Now, I know I could just get on Wikipedia and find out what's going to happen and who's going to fight who, but I kind of don't want to do that. I kind of want to watch it week to week.
Yeah, for sure.
I thought they did a really good job this episode of showing how the conflicts that were introduced at the end of episode 5 have hardened over time.
Mm-hmm. They've calcified, for sure.
Yeah.
And gotten worse.
I thought that first scene with Rhaenyra kind of stumbling her way up to see Alicent.
God, it was horrible.
Was awful, but it was great too, because it's like, this is obviously just another move in a 10-year long fight.
I want to praise the show for doing something here. The line from Alicent where she tells Rhaenyra's husband, "Do keep trying. Sooner or later, you'll get one who looks like you." That yes. had a certain meaning in that moment, and then like 2 seconds later, the meaning shifted just a little, and it was so well done. Like I thought, what an asshole thing to say, and then just a couple of scenes later, you're like, oh, well, see why she said it. And and maybe it's not as cruel. I mean, it's certainly still kind of cruel, but you get it. And this show does a really great job that I don't think a lot of modern shows understand. Shows within the last 15 years do not get that it's okay to withhold information, but some of it needs to be fixed pretty quickly rather than saving it for the last episode.
I would agree with that. Especially this one. What you just said was a good example of that, where she's like, eventually you'll get one that looks like you. And then we think we know what it means. And then
we think it's her being petty, but then...
And then about 5 minutes later, we have Sir Harwin holding the baby that's his son, or exactly. Probably his son. I'm going to say it's almost 100% that they're his kids. So what did you think about, if we're going to rank the kids with Aegon the worst, did you have a favorite now that we have child actors again?
I didn't. I like Harwin's kids. They seem okay.
Yeah, they seem more fine.
The Targaryen kids, especially Aegon, it's mainly just Aegon, and so I don't want him to be representative of all the Targaryen kids, because his youngest brother, who's trying to nurture a relationship with a dragon, he seems okay too.
Poor Aemon. Got picked on this. Was it Aemon? It is Aemon, right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Really got picked on this this episode.
We meet Daemon's new wife, only for her to die pretty instantly.
I wasn't sure about that. No, she's obviously dead. I wasn't sure about how quickly that happened, especially with her telling her dragon to burn her to death. Obviously, it was supposed to parallel, or it was starting to parallel the scene in episode 1, because, you know, the maester asks Daemon if he wants the knife, and she kind of takes matters into her own hands with letting the dragon burn her, mm-hmm. and rather than die in childbirth or die under the knife. But I felt like I wanted just a little longer with her character to see why she might make that choice.
That's a fair complaint, or really fair complaint. So they're in Essos, and I had to Google a Westeros map again. I haven't done that in a while to figure out where exactly they are. And
are they in Westeros?
No,
Essos. Yeah, they're across the sea, right?
Right. I had to Google the whole Westeros map and figure out where Essos was in comparison.
Okay.
It's obvious.
When you said Westeros, you threw me for a minute, because I was like, wait a minute, they're not in Westeros right now. Nope. Daemon is in a self-imposed or otherwise imposed exile.
And
him and his dragons.
He's much more chill, but maybe bored by this.
The only thing that seemed to bring him alive was the talk of resuming battle.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't seem like a super a super invested father. And now he's got two motherless children to take care of, one of whom has a dragon, I believe.
Correct. and the other is his wife who died apparently rode the largest dragon. That's mentioned by Tyrion even in Game of Thrones. It's supposedly the biggest ever.
Yes. And she mentions that to her daughter in that scene where I can't remember her dragon's name.
I missed the whole thing. Yeah, Daemon's boredom's going to play out, of course. Now, I do think that this is where the show needs to stop and concentrate on, stop with the time jumps and concentrate on just letting the rest of the season play out almost in quote-unquote real time.
I think I would agree. What's going to happen, because everything, unless there's a real, next week we could watch episode 7 and be like, oh, there was another big time jump and it totally worked. And it totally makes sense. But I think, especially for me, it was getting to the point where it was just a little bit disorienting. And now that the pieces are really on the board, I want to see how it plays out.
Harrenhal, the cursed Harrenhal, burns by tongueless arsonists. And Rhaenyra sees the danger happening and she flees to Dragonstone, which is not that far away, but she's trying to protect her kids. Because if Larys Strong is killing his own father and brother, then there are no qualms to be made about killing her and her kids.
Boy, he really sucks, doesn't he?
He's one of the worst. We've been through a lot of excellent villains in the Game of Thrones universe. He's no Joffrey, but he is he's pretty much an asshole.
Yeah, I was sad to see his father go, because he does seem like the most honorable character in he was sort of your Ned Stark.
Well, we know what happens to Ned Stark with what I was about to say. I'm in love with the visual of the king dwindling, and as his kingdom does, that analogy there.
I think he's lost his arm at this point. That arm finally went away. His hair is going. He's stooped. He just seems... Paddy, I can't ever... I want to say Constantine is his last name, and it's
Paddy Constantine.
Is doing a great job playing Viserys as this man in decline.
Yes, and I'm glad that actor got to stick around.
Me too. I've really enjoyed watching him.
Does he make it to season 2? Surely not, right?
No way. He's running out of body parts to lose.
He'll just be a torso next season.
Yeah.
All right. That's all I've got. We're running out of time for our usual podcast episode length. So here's what we'll do. Find us on Twitter and Instagram. Let's continue some of this conversation at Taking It Down Pod. That's Instagram and Twitter. Feel free to talk to us there. Tell us how we're all wrong about all of this. And then just follow the Alabama Take in any social media so you can stay on everything related to the site. All right, for Donovan, Adam, and Natalie, I'm Blaine, and I'll see you guys not next week, but the week after. Let's all catch up on some TV.